Last week we were talking about the community growth. We were in chapter 5, and we did scurry along and get to the end of chapter 5 after the calling of Levi and a subsequent conflict that erupted between Jesus and the scribes and the Pharisees. And toward the end, we mentioned the old patches, new cloth, old wine, new wine. That some interpret as no new innovations because old ways are good and comfortable, like old jeans fit better than new jeans. Others interpret them that the new must be based on understanding of the old and grow from such. That is, new understandings of Scripture and of God's expectations through Jesus, but growing from the foundation of what we already have. We don't get new Scriptures, we get new understandings of those. And then we close with the quote, "Faith is never knowledge alone, but readiness to learn afresh from each new encounter with God." That includes with the mind as well as the heart and the spirit. Comments or questions about that before we move to chapter 6, some conflicts over the Sabbath in Luke chapter 6. Okay. Well, then, everybody understood, nobody understood, or you just want to move along. In chapter 6, as Jesus has been teaching, we find, as is his normal custom, on a Sabbath, he is teaching, and here it's providing food. And you can see my parenthesis. I've told some of y'all before that my grandfather Hearn, we called him Pawpaw, took the Sabbath laws and put them on Sunday. And we couldn't go outside and play. We couldn't sit inside and watch TV if we went over and visited, and we did a lot of Sundays. We couldn't play board games, not even Monopoly or Scrabble. We had to sit there and talk with my cousins, with whom I had very little in common. Or we go sit in the living room and listen to all the old folks talk. I loved him to death, but didn't like going over there every Sunday. But it didn't seem to bother him that grandmother got up in the morning and not only cooked breakfast, but cooked lunch. And then for supper, you had leftovers from lunch. I mean, she'd fry chicken or fry pork chops or whatever. You know, so she was providing food, so I guess that was a little bit differently than... We couldn't even go outside and swing on the swing set. So that's why I say parenthetically here, grandmother, you really can fix Papa's lunch on Sunday. Jesus and his disciples are going through the grain field one Sabbath. And this is typical of Luke, just to not tie it down to a specific Sabbath, but one Sabbath on another Sabbath, etc. One Sabbath, which means after sundown on Friday and before sundown on Saturday, most likely it's during the day on Saturday. One Sabbath, while Jesus was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked some heads of grain, rubbed them in their hands, and then ate them. But some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus answered, "Have you not read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for anyone but the priest to eat, and gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath.'" Bless you. Is Lord of the Sabbath. So here we've got a very familiar incident. Jesus and his disciples on the Sabbath are walking through a grain field. Of course, I would have to wonder that we don't tell you, and nobody else would probably wonder, but I would have to wonder, they're walking along. How far did they walk if the Pharisees were following them? Woe be unto them if they went more than a Sabbath day's journey in the walk, because the Pharisees would be breaking the law too. But that didn't seem to matter here. What mattered was the conflict. And when we find Jesus encountering the Pharisees on the Sabbath, there's always conflict. They're going through the grain fields, and they're hungry. So I figure it's probably about lunchtime. And so they reach down as they're going through. The grain is high enough to where it's ripe. It's almost ready for harvest. So they start plucking the heads of grain into their hands. They rub them in their hands. Why do you do that? Yeah? Right? to get the husk off, all that's also threshing. But if you're going to get to the grain, you don't want to eat the husk either, right? Although these days a nutritionist would probably tell you there's more nutrition in the husk. I don't know. But they do that. So plucking it is harvesting. Rubbing it between your hands like this and removing the husk is threshing. And if you kind of toss it, doesn't say to do this, but if you kind of toss it up and let the breeze or blow and let the chaff or the husks go away, that's winnowing. So if you do that, you're breaking three Sabbath laws. By the way, we've mentioned before in other situations, on the Sabbath, you could go your Sabbath day's journey, but say you needed a stick, a walking stick to go with you. I was looking for a broom here. Not one when you need one. But you walk along with your walking stick, and you decide you're lazy and you don't want to do this anymore, and you start dragging it behind you. What law of the Sabbath have you just broken? Plowing, yeah. You just plowed a furrow in the dirt. Seriously. The Pharisees are looking for any nitpicky little thing here. And so they're following Jesus, and immediately they jump on him about, why are you doing what is not lawful? You're breaking the law, and you're supposed to be a great teacher. They're trying to cast aspersion on him, to discredit him. Also, doing like this could be seen, if you did this, the grain, as it mentions here, long enough, that could be seen as grinding it like you would cornmeal, milling it, and that broke the Sabbath law. All kinds of things that broke the Sabbath law. You could actually be writing a letter to someone. Or if you were at work and you were writing down, you're a merchant, somebody's buying something from you, and you're writing a list of what they're buying, you had to be careful, because once the Sabbath began, once the sun touched down there and the Sabbath began, if you were halfway through a letter and you completed that letter, you were doing work and breaking the law of the Sabbath. If you were sewing or stitching something together and the sun touches the horizon and you make one more stitch before you stop, or you tie a knot in the end of the thread to keep it from unraveling until the next day, you've broken the law of the Sabbath. Ridiculous. Kind of like my grandfather saying we couldn't swing on a swing set. But, so they're trying to trap Jesus. Jesus' response, though, places him within the realm of David. He is king over the Sabbath, because he brings David into this. They all love David. They wish things would go back to the time of David as far as the golden age of Israel's kingship. And so he says, wait a minute. Have you not read what David did when he and his men were hungry? They went into where the altar was, and they took the bread of the presence, also called the showbread. Only the priests are supposed to eat that, according to Leviticus. Right, folks? That are up here on Wednesday mornings. Only the priests get to eat that. And at certain times, only the high priest gets to eat it, not the rest of them. But David went in, he ate it anyway, he gave some to his men, they were able to survive, and God didn't strike them down with a lightning bolt. Something that they can't argue with, because the Pharisees know, historically, that happened. And they know, historically, David was not condemned for it. God allowed it to happen, and God did not condemn David, nor did the priests at the time. So he said, then if David can do this, the Son of Man, he's referring to himself here, and in the Gospel of John he very often refers to himself as Son of Man or Lamb of God or Word of God. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. What he is indicating here is that he is doing something for life. He is king over the Sabbath. And he is doing something for living or for life which trumps Sabbath law. There are certain things, he says, which trump Sabbath law. Edward Schweizer, left the H out of that name, said the law is annulled only in a fulfillment that looks for the will of God expressed in the law, not for the letter of the law. In other words, you can not do the Sabbath law. And he said, what Jesus is saying is you don't have to abide by the Sabbath law if what you are doing is for the good of life and fulfills the desire of God. That is, that this person doesn't go hungry. That's better than trying to keep the letter of the law and allowing... It's sinful to let someone else go hungry. Only faith can understand freedom from the law for love of God and others. So here Jesus has done this, his defining work. He is tying to being the Son of Man, descended from the line of David. David, who the Pharisees have to admit, did something he wasn't supposed to, but it was for the good of his men, to keep them alive. Therefore, Jesus says, if it's for the good. You know, you could save someone's life on the Sabbath, but you couldn't do anything more. Use the example before, but I'll quickly use it again. If we were here before this place was no longer a cow pasture, but it used to be a pasture for the mill village, and you're walking along, and TJ happens to decide, it's the Sabbath, and TJ happens to decide he's going to climb over the fence and walk through this field. Of course, he watches where he steps. But he walks through this field. The cows are all out here. Some of them are lying down. Some of them standing up eating. And then he forgets, though, that inside that fence is also this big bull. Until he hears the rumble of hoof prints behind him. And he turns and he looks and he goes, ah! And he starts running toward the fence. Well, William's walking along the road, and it's the Sabbath now. They're Jewish, and it's the Sabbath. William's walking along the road, and he looks and he sees. He said, I think that bull, TJ's not going to make it. That bull's going to get him. He's going to be a hair and a half too slow, and that bull's going to get him. So he watches, and he goes up, and he's encouraging him. Come on, TJ, come on, a little bit more. And about the time TJ almost gets to the fence, he's two hairs too short. And too slow. The bull hooks him with a horn, smashes his leg, and slings him into the barbed wire, and he's hanging there in the barbed wire fence. The bull goes and decides to make another pass. He's coming around the pasture. And TJ said, William, help me! Help me! William said, well, you know, it's the Sabbath, you know. Seriously. It's a Sabbath. And so William looks, and he looks at that bull, and he says, you know, if I don't help him, that bull's probably going to kill him. So the bull makes a turn. William grabs hold. He pulls. And he pulls a little more. TJ says, ow, that hurts. He said, that's all right. And he rips him out of the barbed wire and slams him to the ground on this side. The bull misses him. He just saved TJ's life. TJ says, William, thank you. That man, that was great. Thank you so much. William says, that's all right. You'd have done it for me. See you later. And William turns around and walks off. Now, we'd think that's horrible. TJ's laying there, torn up from the barbed wire, and he's got a smashed leg from the bull. But according to Sabbath law, William did all that he could. He saved his life. He couldn't do any more. You couldn't carry him. That's bearing a burden. You could not carry him to the doctor. And even if he got to the doctor could not, as long as he's not going to die before the Sabbath's over, the doctor can't do anything to help him without breaking the Sabbath law. You could save a person's life, but you couldn't do anything more. No, I couldn't give him an aspirin. Couldn't even put it in a splint. That's it. So what Jesus was indicating is, you know, there is something. I mean, that's what the Sabbath law had gotten to and what it said. But Jesus said, it's not just keeping the letter of the law. It's doing something good for someone to help them on the Sabbath, even if it doesn't mean they're going to die. But you do good for them on the Sabbath. That's, if you do that because of the love of God and love of others, that trumps Sabbath law. Pharisees didn't agree with him, but they couldn't argue with his David example here. So they start following him around some more. On another Sabbath, Jesus heals. Here he's provided food for sustenance, he and his disciples. Another Sabbath, he heals, and he does it of all places in the synagogue. If he'd just taken the guy out in the alley, wouldn't have been anything said, but he's in the synagogue. On another Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and taught. and there was a man there whose right hand was withered. Bless you. The scribes and Pharisees watched him to see whether he would cure on the Sabbath so that they might find an accusation against him. Notice in the other story it's the Pharisees, although I think there are probably a few scribes there. Here it's the scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes were a subset of the Pharisees that knew the law backwards and forwards. And so they said, okay, let's see if we can catch him on something. Would he dare heal in here? Even though he knew what they were thinking, he said to the man who had the withered hand, come and stand here. And he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, I ask you, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? To save a life or to destroy it? And they didn't answer it. After looking around at all of them, he said to him, stretch out your hand. He did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. So, Jesus saying, go ahead, see the doctor, TJ. Don't let gangrene set in, then I have to take a saw. Once again, Jesus is teaching on the Sabbath, and teaching and healing go hand in hand. Throughout the Gospel of Luke, we will find teaching and healing very often go hand in hand. We've seen that already. Jesus will be teaching, then he will heal. And so that happens here. The scribes are looking for a way to discredit him, and Jesus knows that. When it says he knows their thoughts, he knows what they're thinking. He knows what they're doing. I mean, you can tell from folks. You've known them well enough. You've seen them operate well enough. You know what they're thinking, even if they don't speak it. Right? You have folks you can do that with. And so, he knows that, and he looks around and challenges them when he says to the man. I mean, he knew what they were thinking. Jesus could have walked out, no problem. But he looked at the man, he said, come here. Come here. He challenges them with a question and a demonstration. Does the Sabbath, which was given for rest and recreation, preclude doing good or saving life? And the word for life here is the word for soul. Saving one's... So, see, it's not just saving the life. It's the potential of saving the soul. Forgiveness. Not just healing, but forgiveness here as well. Because what would they have thought with this man with a withered hand? Somebody had sinned, whether it was him or his mother or his grandmother or his great-great second cousin three times removed on the 14th side of his aunt. Yeah. Somebody back there did. So he challenged him. Or is doing good on the Sabbath by doing an action which is breaking the Sabbath law evil and destructive? He said, okay, tell me. Can you do good or do harm? Can you save a life or destroy it? If you save the life, is that not good? But if you let it go and let the person die because of the letter of the Sabbath law, is that evil or good? They can't answer it. I mean, how do you answer that? Is it evil or good? Some people would say, well, you didn't break the law of Sabbath, so it's still good. Other people would say, but you could have saved him, and you didn't, and that's evil. Or healing a man with a withered hand, or fixing TJ's smashed up leg. Some people would say, hey, you don't fix it because that'd break the Sabbath law. So it's good that you leave his leg smashed up. Somebody else would say, yeah, but what if he gets a blood clot, or what if it's gangrene or something else like that between now and then? Or what if he can't even hobble home? He has to lay out here in the bears and the lions and the tigers and the bears. Thank you. Come by while he's here. So to help him, is it good or evil? Jesus, before he even does it, he lays down a challenge. He throws down the gauntlet. He brings this man up there. They're looking. The Pharisees and the scribes are looking around the crowd saying, who in here might he help? Calls this man up, standing there with a withered hand, and before he even does it, he turns and looks at him and challenges him, and they do not say a word. Why? Because he's got them between a rock and a hard place. You're in the crowd, in the synagogue, and now he asks the question about good and evil, helping or not, and they can't answer it. They're afraid to answer it. And so he heals the man with a withered or the useless hand. he does a good. But the scribes and the Pharisees do evil.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. You may.
The word which is lawful on the Sabbath, we're talking about law here, right?
We're talking about Sabbath law. We're not talking about civil law.
Okay. Couldn't they just say, well, could have waited till tomorrow?
Right.
He wasn't dying.
No, he wasn't dying, but Jesus is trying to tell them that.
I know, but I mean,
they could have.
If they wanted to respond to him.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if they want, you're right, Ariel. If they wanted to, they could have said that. But then what they're trying to do is, first of all, they're trying to trap Jesus. Secondly, they want to choose their words carefully in front of all these other people because they don't want to seem too callous.
I know, but
yeah.
If you're thinking about the lawfulness of it,
yeah,
they would have had a reason.
Yeah, they could have had a reason, but they chose not to.
And is the Orthodox Jew still holding these?
Oh, Orthodox Jew holds the law to the letter. Conservative, even today, the Orthodox Hasidic Jews, they hold the letter of the law, period. There is nothing greater than the law and keeping the law. It does to us. Conservative Jews are very big on the law, but they also believe that the law is meant to change with time, but changes very slowly. Reformed Judaism, I know a Reformed Jewish... that's redundant, Jewish rabbi. I know a former rabbi in the upstate that he was raised in a Jewish household. He studied in seminary. He leads in worship, and he leads through the special high holy days. But theologically, he is a Neoplatonist. He's more in line with the thought of Plato than and some of the other things that come out of that than he is with theology in the Hebrew Scriptures. But the Orthodox Hasidic Jew will only live in a Jewish neighborhood, only shop at the kosher stores and all that kind of stuff. We saw something the other day that I've never seen before. I've seen all kinds of other things. But we're standing in line at the grocery store, and there's this display with Passover potato chips.
Lay's. They were Lay's.
Yeah, Lay's. Passover potato chips. Said on the thing, Passover potato chips. Gluten-free.
They have shepherds
as
kosher.
Oh, yeah. Gluten-free. Of course, I hadn't figured out gluten-free and potatoes, but it was Passover potato chips. But the Orthodox Jew today will do that. They go to the extreme with the law. There is nothing greater than the law. And actually, there are certain times of the day, we think of Muslims as praying five times a day. Jews are supposed to pray at least three times a day, including the middle of the afternoon. The Orthodox Hasidic Jew will do that. You will see them. If you're around 3 o'clock in an airport, or somewhere else, or in it, they'll stop, they'll put on their phylacteries and everything, and they'll go in the corner and do their prayers and then get ready and leave again. So the law was extremely important to these folks. And yes, they could have said, well, why can't you wait till tomorrow? But Jesus is right there in their face, and they're looking at the crowd around them, and they decide not to bring this up. But what they do then is they get... says they are filled with fury. I mean, that means they are absolutely, they're spitting mad. Let's put it that way. They're spitting mad. And they start discussing, what's really interesting, Jesus does good, they start discussing evil intentions against Jesus. And they're doing it, as I say, on the Sabbath. And what did he just ask them? About doing good or doing evil on the Sabbath. And he does good, and they do exactly the opposite. They do evil on the Sabbath. This legalism can actually get in the way of doing good, is what Jesus says. And Luke is indicating here with this story that the Christian community is to seek always to grow together, even through the conflicts that may come. They're to seek to grow together, to find a way to do good as opposed to evil. To do good as opposed to evil. Other questions before we move along to the next section, which is the new handout from tonight. And we will not get all the way through this. I already know it. It's 6:30. But this is in chapter 6, continuing, and there are two major sections left in chapter 6. the calling of disciples or choosing apostles. That's verses 12 to 19. And then something we call the Sermon on the Plain, P-L-A-I-N, in verses 20 through 49. Very much like the sermon, well, in some ways like the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. But I offered to serve. So. Now I got to clean up where I dropped. Do what? Nah. Now this is Sunday. That's what I said. That's what I'd say to my grandfather. It's Sunday. It's not the Sabbath. He didn't buy that, so that's okay. The Sermon on the Plain, as opposed to the Sermon on the Mount, and we may get to some of that later this evening, but the bulk of it next time. But Jesus calls disciples. Now, what have we seen before? He called disciples, but how many did he call so far in Luke? Now, before this, he actually only called four. He had Peter, three, and then a fourth came along. He had residual, I said collateral damage, and we had collateral gains. So we really don't have but a few that have been called to this point. But Jesus, we're told here, now during those days he went out to the mountain to pray, and he spent the night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose 12 of them, whom he also named apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, and his brother Andrew, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James, son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Jesus goes to the mountain to pray before making decisions. We will find this very often in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus will go to the mountain. The mountain symbolizes his nearness with God. It's where he communes with his closest followers. It also symbolizes his nearness to God. In the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus teaches or deals with the crowds, it's always down on their level, as we said the first night. In the Gospel of Matthew, topography is important. When Jesus teaches the crowds, Jesus is always in an elevated position. In Matthew, on the mountain, on a hillside, in a boat, looking down. Why? Because it's written primarily, Matthew is written primarily for Jews and Jewish Christian readers. And for them, who went on the mountain and was important? Moses. Yeah. And the law of Moses. So Jesus goes on the mountain to give the law and explain the law because he has the authority. Moses had to go on the mountain to get the law and the authority. Therefore, to the Jewish readers, Jesus is superior to Moses. Follow Jesus. Not necessarily the law of Moses. Every time Jesus teaches the crowds in Matthew, he's in an elevated position. When Jesus deals with the common everyday situations of life and the crowds in Luke, he's always on their level. Fits into Luke's understanding of Jesus coming for everyone, not just the high and mighty, but anyone, the outcast, the poor, the hungry, the diseased. So Jesus goes on the mountain to pray. Jesus sometimes will be on the mountain with some of his followers to teach them, his closest followers, the apostles. But when he deals with the crowds, he's always come down off the mountain to meet them where they are. And he goes to the mountain here before choosing the specific 12 to commune with God. Some scholars say that what it's an indication of is that Jesus in his human form will not do anything in and of himself, but will always commune with the Father before he makes major decisions. Okay? Maybe, maybe not. But here he is doing that before making this big decision. Luke has only spoken of a few specific disciples, but he presumes and knows of many others who were following Jesus early on, whether it was out of curiosity or because, it might have been in part, because he was having confrontations with the Pharisees and the scribes, and some of them are following along to see Well, I wonder what he'll say next and how he'll get them. Because for far too long, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees had kept people at arm's distance or kind of under their thumb. Jesus chooses 12. Notice, that's the same number as the number of patriarchal tribes in Israel. 12 tribes of Israel. Oh, go to the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, and the New Jerusalem sits on 12 foundations with 12 gates, and written on those are the names of the 12 tribes of Israel and the names of the 12 apostles. Continuity. And Luke is also trying to show that what Jesus does is still based upon, remember in the birth narratives, he's the one who talked about they did according to the law, according to the law, according to the law. And Luke the Gentile is trying to show this isn't just a brand new out of the air religion. There is some foundation to this, and it's Judeo-Christian heritage. And he designates those 12 as apostles. The word apostle means one sent with a message. Disciple is a learner, and apostle is someone sent out with a message. Luke here designates them apostles because in Acts, the second volume that Luke writes, they are known either as the 12 or the apostles. They become the first missionaries out there. An apostle is sent with a message like an ambassador from a king would go. Or we send ambassadors to other countries, supposedly to speak on behalf of our legislative body and our president and all that kind of stuff. It's the same thing. The apostles are those 12 who are always close to Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, who hear all of his teachings, not just the ones the crowds hear. He takes them aside and talks to them. They are the first ones to receive the Spirit, and they become the first missionaries. They are not, G down here, they are not sacred or holier than thou people. They're not the super religious or the pious, like I said last time. They're ordinary fishers, tax collectors. Basically, they're lower middle class at best. The disciples, those 12, with the exception maybe of Judas Iscariot, they are lower middle class. So he has fishers, tax collectors, and at least one zealot, Simon the Zealot, and some people think Judas might have been a zealot. By the way, just kind of threw in here, Simon also named Peter. You'll find Simon called in different places. Our English word is Peter. It comes from Petros, which means rock. Cephas, or Kephas, is Aramaic. It means rock or stone. It's not a second name. It's a nickname. It's a descriptive name. That he's a rock. Or kind of like, you know, a lot of people think that Saul of Tarsus changed his name to Paul when he became a Christian to signify the change. No, Paul is the Greek and / Latin forms of the Hebrew Saul. And that's why he's known as Paul. Not because he changed it, because he became a Christian. Now, the apostles are surrounded by other disciples, and a lot of other disciples. There are a lot of folks, and Jesus chooses these 12 from among them. It's also, this story of choosing the 12 apostles is tied to the section dealing with the Sermon on the Plain, because there are all these other followers, they form the backdrop. They're the ones to whom Jesus is preaching in the Sermon on the Plain. It's similar to the early communities with which Luke would have been familiar, that is, universal in scope. If we continue to read in verses 17 and following, and he came down with them, that is, the 12 and another smaller group, and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea, Jerusalem, and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon were both predominantly Gentile cities. So we've got a cross-section of society here. Jesus has a whole cross-section of society with him. Not just the upper class, not just the lower class, but all points in between. not just Jews, but Gentiles as well, here in between. And they had come to hear Him and to be healed of their diseases. Notice once again, teaching or the Word and healing in Luke go hand in hand. Of course, Luke's a doctor, a physician. But notice the first thing that is said. Earlier, last week we were talking about it, they came to hear His words and He healed some of them. Here it says, they had come to hear Him and to be healed. The hearing of Jesus' word comes prior to the healing. The hearing of Jesus' word comes prior to the healing. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all in the crowd were trying to touch Him, for power came out from Him and healed all of them. On Jesus' very touch, power came forth and healing took place. Some of them want, they're in awe of the power. And maybe they're there to see what He might do next. He's going to give somebody the holy claw on the forehead, or blow His breath at them and knock them down or whatever. Some of them are coming in awe of the power. Others are coming to see the show. Others, perhaps, we got Gentiles in here especially. There were some Jewish superstitions, but especially these Gentiles. Many of their religions had all kinds of superstitions around being around someone that had power and trying to catch some of that power or tap into some of that power. So there were probably some there too who, because of the superstitions of their various Greek and Roman mystery religions, were trying to, if we can just get a glimpse of it, maybe we can catch or tap into that power and it'll be ours too. Yeah, there are people that do that. And our people that get taken in. I think the number of places along the road between here and, well, actually between probably Aner and Flo's place, Florence, I think the number of those houses that have a big hand on the sign out front has increased many times. Spiritual advisor. Saw one that had the big hand. Spiritual advisor on the sign, and stop in. And on the bottom it said, $10 special. But there was a half moon drawn on the bottom of it and some stars. And then right next to the sign, guess what there was? See if any of y'all paid attention to it. I'm not even sure you were. A big statue of a blonde-haired, he had his eyes closed, but in a light blue and white robe, standing like this, a big statue of Jesus. Right beside the big hand with the spiritual advisor on it. There's still people out there with all those kinds of things. The sign came before the statue of Jesus because it's too new. Yeah, the sign came before the statue of Jesus. Yeah. So these crowds are here. Jesus is showing His power, which also grabs their attention. And so He's got them all around, and He healed all of those who touched Him and who really sought it were healed. And then Jesus looks out on the crowd. He's on their level. He's in the middle of this large group of people, and He begins to teach them. In something we call the Sermon on the Plain, which is shorter than the Sermon on the Mount. But the Sermon on the Plain is more of a call to action. Salvation has as much to do with action as hearing the good news, according to Luke. Once you hear the words, you have to act, or simply hearing the words does you no good. And that's why, among other things, we said that first night too, that Luke has sometimes been referred to as the social gospel because of action. You hear the words of Jesus, then you must act. And who are you acting for? Not the rich and the pickled pious, but those who are in need. The poor, the hungry, the diseased, the outcast. And it's at that point, with Jesus standing among a crowd full of those kind of folks, that we'll pick up next Sunday night. It's only 30 seconds past. How about that? And we'll start looking at the Sermon on the Plain and some of those specific teachings that challenge us to action, a call to action.
You know what's sad, preacher?
What's that, William?
When you talk about this, these stories about that healing and all that, going on back then, what's going on today? There's people still, I'm sure people don't believe when I see it.
Well, healing goes on in a lot of different ways, even today.